email that I sent out with the source sheet, we just have too much material for the 3 weeks. There's no way around it. And it's not something we could wrap up by doing an extra 10, 15 minutes today. So I plan to have a fourth session in our series next week. No, there's no fee for it. Complimentary. So I hope to see you at 10 o'clock next Wednesday for week 4. And yeah, hopefully we'll finish it within that time. Because after that, we have Jews and Numerology as our next series starting December 8th. That's going to be a lot of fun. So we are talking about Rehoboam, the son of Solomon, and the schism that takes place in his time. We already noted that there is a history of a split in the Jewish world going all the way back to the time of Rachel and Leah and their kids. The split does not necessarily go on neat lines and say that all the way throughout the generations, this group on one side, this group on the other, Benjamin ends up on both sides of the line at different times. But there is a fault line among the Jews, and it particularly plays out between north and south in the land of Israel. That's number one. Number two is Rehoboam. We were introduced to Rehoboam. He is the son of Solomon and Naamah. Naamah is a woman from Ammon. That's really important, and we're going to come back to why it's important a little bit later. But right now, recognize the tribe of Ammon is a tribe that is not supposed to be able to marry into the Jewish people. The women are allowed to marry in, the men are not allowed to marry in, because when the Jews were in the wilderness on their way into the land of Israel, Ammon would not allow them to cross peacefully through their territory into the land of Israel. There's more to be said about our relationship with Ammon, but the key point right now to understand is that he's coming from this mother into the Jewish people. We read the part that I brought you with source number one on the sheet, and for anyone who doesn't have the source sheet, I did put the link in the chat, so hopefully people can get that. I'll put the link in the chat again for those who have just joined. But we read through this last time, Kings 1, chapter 12, and what we saw was that Rehoboam is anointed as king by the northern tribes in the city of Shechem after his father passes away. The northern tribes send a delegation to Rehoboam to say, your father really oppressed us in terms of our tax burden. And tax burden can mean a financial tax. Tax burden can also, though, mean a labor tax, meaning taking their young men and saying, you now have to work for me in my construction projects, and so on. So they say, it was too much, lighten the burden on us, and we will be loyal to you. And he went to his father Solomon's advisors and asked them for advice, and their advice was, be a servant to the nation, and then they will serve you. Be humble, it'll work out. And he did not like that advice at all. And instead, he turned to the people he had grown up with, a younger generation. And he asked them for advice. And they said, you should tell them who's boss. You should tell them, you're a big man. You're bigger than your father was. That's what you should do. And that's what he does. He likes that idea. And as we saw, it's in source number one on the sheet. He said, my father made your yoke heavy. I will add to your yoke. My father flogged you with whips. I will flog you with scorpions. And we saw a line, which we're going to come back to, what I want to note here. It's in parentheses in the JPS translation. The king did not listen to the people, for the Lord had brought it about in order to fulfill the promise that the Lord had made through Achia Hashiloni to Yerobam, son of Nevat. Meaning, the promise that we saw last time, that Yerobam was going to be given most of the Jewish people to rule as punishment for the idolatry that happened in the time of Solomon. So this is, you know, Rehoboam's response to the people, this harsh response to the people. And when the Jews see, these northern tribes see, that Rehavam is not listening, so their response is to declare the end of source number one, we have no portion in David, no share in Jesse's son. To your tents, O Israel, look to your own house, O David. You go your way, we will go our way. The Israelites return to their homes. Rehavam continued to reign over the Israelites who lived in the towns of Judah, those who are living in the south, and that's what leads to the stoning of his tax collector and Rehavam massing troops for war against the northern tribes, which we saw in the beginning of this session last week. So does everyone remember where we are? That's okay. We have a basic sense of, okay, good. So two different ways to understand what happened here with Rehavam. Two complementary ways, really, to understand what happened here with Rehavam, each with lessons for us. Last time we started on the idea that this is a religious story. This is telling me what happens when the nation sins. Solomon married foreign wives, importing idolatry into his monarchy, and God's reaction was to say, I am taking most of the monarchy away from your son. If you take a look at source number 2 on the sheet from Kings 1, chapter 11, and God said to Solomon, because this was with you, these actions were with you, you did not guard my covenant and my laws which I commanded you, I will tear the throne from upon you and give it to your servant. But I will not do it in your days for the sake of your father David. I will tear it from your son, but I will not tear the entire empire. I will give your son one tribe for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. So I'm taking away most of the empire. He actually is giving him one tribe, but it's one tribe which are two, because he gives him Benjamin also as part of this. Benjamin and Judah are united in the city of Jerusalem. And that is the starting point for this punishment. The verses in Kings 1 continue to talk about how God sets up certain enemies for Solomon. Hadad from Edom, who was an enemy of King David, had been staying in Egypt. He now comes back to support trouble against Solomon. The king of Aram starts trouble for Solomon. And then you get source number 3. Source number 3 is what we alluded to in the parenthetical sentence about a promise that God made to Yerubbaal, son of Nevat. Who is Yerubbaal? What promise are you talking about? It's in source number 3. Yerubbaal, son of Nevat, was an Ephraimite of Tzireda. He was from the tribe of Ephraim, which is northern kingdom. Ephraim is a descendant of Rachel. And he was the son of a widow whose name was Tziruah. He was in Solomon's service. He worked for Solomon. But he raised his hand against the king. The circumstances under which he raised his hand against the king were as follows. Solomon had a big construction project called the Milo. He repaired the breach of the city of his father David. This Yerubbaal, you see it says Jeroboam, but I keep saying Yerubbaal, which is the Hebrew. This Yerubbaal was an able man. When Solomon saw the young man was a capable worker, he appointed him over all the forced labor of the house of Joseph. So this fellow, Yerubbaal, is in charge of all the workers who are now compelled to work on the construction project. During that time, Yerubbaal went out of Jerusalem. He left Jerusalem. The prophet Achiah of Shiloh met him on the way. He had put on a new robe. And when the two were alone in the open country, Achiah took hold of the new robe he was wearing and tore it into 12 pieces. Take 10 pieces, he said to Yerubbaal. For thus said the Lord, the God of Israel, I am about to tear the kingdom out of Solomon's hands, and I will give you 10 tribes. But one tribe shall remain his, for the sake of my servant David, for the sake of Jerusalem, the city that I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel. So he says to him, tearing this cloak into 12 symbolizes the 12 tribes. There are 10 that are going to you, one that is going to him, and of course you'll say, well, 10 plus 1 does not equal 12. The answer is either somehow this is a reference to the tribe of Levi, perhaps, which doesn't really get into the 12, or it's a reference to Benjamin also going as part of Judah to with the south. Either way, he says this is a punishment because they have worshipped Ashtoreth and Chemosh and Milcom. They have not walked in my ways, done what is pleasing to me, kept my laws and rules, as Solomon's father did. However, I will not take the entire kingdom away from him, but will keep him as ruler as long as he lives, for the sake of my servant David, whom I chose and who kept my commandments and my laws. But I will take the kingship out of the hands of his son, Rehoboam, and give it to you, the 10 tribes. To his son I will give 1 tribe, as we've already said. It's a little redundant, but this is the way prophets speak sometimes. And he continues to say, but you have been chosen by me, reign wherever you wish, and you shall be king over Israel. If you heed all that I command you, and walk in my ways, and do what is right in my sight, keeping my laws and commandments as my servant David did, then I will be with you, and I will build for you a lasting dynasty as I did for David. I hereby give Israel to you. I will chastise David's descendants for that sin, although not forever. So, Yeravam is now officially the leader of a coup. Solomon sought to put Yeravam to death, but Yeravam promptly fled to King Shishak of Egypt and remained in Egypt till the death of Solomon. Right? There's a remarkable irony here in terms of where he goes. Where does Yeravam get refuge?
Egypt.
In Egypt. Right. What's the irony in that?
Well, we came from Egypt as slaves.
Well, that's true, but what else? We didn't read it this week. We read it last week. I have to remember from last week. Solomon's first foreign wife was the daughter of the Pharaoh. Right? We talked about how that's where the idolatry begins. And how she brought the music of the idols, as the Talmud reported it. So, the Egypt is now the place where his enemy is taking shelter. That doesn't necessarily mean that this Shishak in Egypt is actually Solomon's father-in-law. Like, time has elapsed. So, the old Shishak is dead, this is a new Shishak. In any case, Solomon now knows that the empire is going to be split. I also wonder a little bit, if you've ever read the book of Ecclesiastes, which we talked about in week 1 of this series, it's attributed to Solomon. So it's a very bitter book. He basically spends the entire book going around and around in circles, talking about all the different pursuits he had and the things he tried and how they led to nothing. And especially about how all the wealth he amassed and all the things he's built, he's going to leave to his children after him, and it's all going to go to waste. Right? That's basically what you see in the book of Ecclesiastes until we get the conclusion of just, do what you're supposed to do, fear God, and that's the entirety of the human being. And I sort of wonder if this right here isn't what Solomon is so bitter about. Because he's finding out that after his death, it's all going down the tubes. The monarchy is going to be split. Maybe he knows a little bit about his son Rehoboam, who's taking over. But that's where this goes. I see your hand, Ruth. I'm just going to go a little further first.
Okay.
One question that you might ask when you read this: you're telling me Solomon worshipped idols, or he brought in wives who worshipped idols. And therefore the monarchy is going to be lost from his next generation. Is this a case of punishing descendants for the sins of their ancestors? Right? Rehoboam isn't the one who committed the crimes. Rehoboam isn't even there on the scene as a monarch yet. It was Solomon who committed the crimes. Right? So is this a case of punishing the descendants for the sin of the ancestors? So I think not. I think not. And the reason I think not is because we have a classic line in the Talmud explaining a challenge of biblical verses. There's one biblical verse that says that, in fact, God will punish children for the sins of the parents, poked avon avot al banim, that God is going to visit the sins of the ancestors on their descendants. And on the other hand, I have another verse that says each person dies for their own sin, not for the sins of the ancestors. So the rabbinic resolution of that is that where the descendants continue in the path of sin of the parents, they establish a cross-generational pattern, then God says, well, they're not changing. And that's why God says, time is up, and he'll punish them for what they do wrong. Well, following that approach here, take a look at source number 4, please. Let's see what Rehoboam did during his reign. And Rehoboam, son of Solomon, reigned in Judea. Rehoboam was 41 years old when he became king. He reigned for 17 years in Jerusalem, the city God chose from all the tribes of Israel on which to place his name. And his mother's name was Naamah of Ammon. And Judea performed that which was evil in the eyes of God, and they were outrageous to him beyond all that their ancestors sinned. They also built for themselves altars and monuments and asherim, which is a form of idolatry associated with trees, upon every hill and beneath every leafy tree. And there were also male prostitutes in the land. They performed all of the abhorrent practices of the nations God had removed from before Israel. So in other words, they continue the idolatry that existed before. And maybe that's why God brings this upon them. He says this is already a cross-generational pattern in them. Okay. Rose, you were going to ask.
I'm just going to make two comments, if you don't mind. One is, you know, we're always interconnected with Egypt. We're always going backwards and forwards. And is there significant, and also the word Egypt is narrow, I think it means narrow. Is there any subtle meaning to this? That's the first thing. And the second thing is, once Abraham, with the Akedah, that was the only thing that wasn't a Brit. A chef said, I am making an oath to you for all generations to come, even if you sin and you do terrible things, I will forgive you because of the faith of the Akedah. And is that why we always forgive it?
So, okay, there's a lot there. In terms of the standing relationship between the Jews and Egypt, that's absolutely a Tanakh-long theme. Remember that Egypt is the gorilla in the Middle East. They are the large power. They're not going anywhere. Whereas in the land of Canaan that becomes our land, you find raiders and attackers and Philistine sea people and all of these different groups raiding from the east, from the west, from the north. You will find later in history that there will be invasions coming in from Assyria and from Babylon and from Greece. All the empires will invade coming in from the north and east. Egypt is anchored. And so all of those empires, when they invade, actually end up battling Egypt. So it becomes Assyria versus Egypt, Babylon versus Egypt, Greece versus Egypt. Everyone wants to get there. So they're really the big force that you can't ignore, number one. Number two, on a religious level, Israel and Egypt are painted as opposites. Multiple times in the Torah, God warns the Jews, don't go back to Egypt. I told you you would never see Egypt again. Maimonides actually records it as law that a Jew is not allowed to live in Egypt, which of course, yes, Maimonides lived in Egypt. So there's a lot of discussion about what he was doing living in Egypt if he said you're not supposed to live there. But the point is that, yes, there is an opposition between the Jews and Egypt, an opposition and attraction between the Jews and Egypt throughout Tanakh. That's in terms of that point. Yeah, I'm basically just acknowledging what you're saying. The name Mitzrayim, Meitzar, we take to mean narrow, and Misr in Arabic is the name for Egypt. Egypt is not not the Arabic name. What to do with that in terms of narrow, I could suggest things, but who knows. Dolly, I was wondering about the geography. I was thinking about that also. The covenant that we get has two sides to it, the covenant with God. On the one hand, it is God saying, I will always be ready to take you back when you repent. On the other hand, the covenant is also God saying, I'm going to hold you to account when you sin. I'm not going to just let you go. So, you know, you have both sides in that. Okay. Yeah, Dahlia, you have to unmute. Dahlia, you're muted. Yeah.
Okay, this makes me very sad, because after this, we lose the north, and eventually we lose the south, and this is our tragedy of our, till we get 1948.
So,
this is a long, sad life.
Yes and no. I mean, yes, it's sad for sure. Yes, we lose the north, and then we lose the south. When we get to Yoshiyahu, which will, you know, this will be next week's part of Yoshiyahu, we're going to find that there is actually a return of the northern tribes, number one. And number two, let's not forget, since Hanukkah is coming up next week, that you also have the Second Temple period, which lasts for centuries. So, you know, we do, it doesn't match the first, but it exists. Okay. Other questions and comments? Yes, Rosalyn.
So, in this just passage that we read, number four,
yeah,
it mentions Rahab's mother, Nama of Ammon, and
yes,
right after, and she's not a Hebrew, but she's from a good tribe. Is that correct? Isn't there something in the last week where they talk about two good cuttings, Ruth and this,
yes,
woman?
Yes.
So she's supposed to be good, right?
She is good. She is good. Ammon is bad.
But then right after, they go into this awful litany of sins. So she's good, and then the sin, but I don't, like, there has to be a reason why they're correlated.
That was perfect. Do you have last week's sheet with you?
I do.
So if you take a look there at the cuttings, right?
Yeah.
The source,
yeah,
right after that is a passage from the Talmud.
Oh, Rabbi David Kimchi.
Oh, Rabbi David Kimchi. Kimchi, sorry. He's not Korean.
He's not Korean.
No. What I was thinking of was that quote, though. It is from Rabbi David Kimchi. That's the one. He points out there, you'll see it there on your sheet, that the text out of nowhere brings Rehoboam's mother's name and her nation, and then says, and the Jews all went into idolatry, and he says, because that is the source of the idolatry for Rehoboam, the heritage that comes from his mother's side. Do you see that there?
Yeah, but she's good.
She is good, but there's a whole lot of baggage that he gets with that whole side of his family. It's not just her he's getting. He's getting a whole heritage. It's
you
not...
want to hear about my family?
No, but that's exactly the point. When you marry somebody, you're marrying their family. And that's what Solomon is doing here. Even if she is good, and she is presented as good, nonetheless, this heritage comes back to bite, you know, through Rehoboam. That's the lesson I think that we're supposed to take here.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I found that it says Talmud, and then it's got Yevamot 63a.
Yeah.
God said to Abraham, I have two
right
good cuttings.
That's the good one. That's the positive one. And then Rabbi Kimchi is the negative one. You got it.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. So this is all one explanation for what went wrong with Rehoboam. It is the punishment really not of Rehoboam, it's the punishment of Solomon. That's really what what it's about. We're going to have to talk about the free will issue. I'm not ignoring that. Like, then does that mean this had to happen and so on? We'll get to that. But first I want to show you a second approach to what happened. I'm going to mute by default, just I'm getting a little bit of background noise. So when people want to speak up, just know you'll have to unmute. Okay. So the second approach to this is that this is a political lesson. Because there is a basic flaw in hereditary rule. The Torah's assumption is that monarchy is hereditary. Like, by definition of monarchy, really, this is different from other types of leadership. One of the ways is that it is hereditary. Take a look at source number 5, passage in Deuteronomy chapter 17, in which we are told that the king has to have a Torah scroll with him at all times, so that his heart not become elevated above his brethren, so that he not stray from the command right or left, so that he will extend his reign, he and his progeny, in the midst of Israel. Supposed to be passing it along to the descendants, and I brought you source number 6 from Samuel 2, when God tells David that Solomon is going to be king after him. He says, your house and reign will be steadfast forever before you, your throne will be established forever. Your line is supposed to continue. The Talmud in Horiot, in source number 7, says something about this which is going to matter for us shortly. So you know, look at this carefully. The passage says, we do not anoint a king, son of a king. Meaning, anointing is something you do when you're starting a royal line. Once you've started the royal line, it just goes. So there's no need to anoint somebody who's inheriting the throne. How do we know this? Rav Acha bar Yaakov said from that passage in source number 5. It says that it's an inheritance, so there's no need to anoint the next one. Having said that, you know that there's a flaw. The flaw is that a hereditary monarchy is only as strong as its weakest link. You're telling me that the kid's going to get the throne. What if the kid is not worthy? Take a look at source number 8, where Maimonides says something very sharp. I love this line. I've used it in other classes, but I love this line. It could be we've done it before. He says in number 8, not only monarchy, but all power and all appointments in Israel are inherited by his son and grandson forever. Yes, this is male language. That's a whole other discussion. But only if the son fills the place of his father in wisdom and reverence. If he fills it in reverence, reverence meaning reverence for God, is what he's talking about. If he fills it in reverence for God, then even if he does not fill it in wisdom, we appoint him in place of his father and we teach him. So if the kid doesn't know as much as the father, is not as brilliant as the father, but is God-fearing, you can teach people stuff. But anyone who lacks reverence for heaven may not be appointed to any position in Israel, even if he is of great wisdom. If he doesn't have reverence, you can't expect to teach that. That's a character flaw. So don't appoint somebody who lacks character. Brains, you can learn. Character? No. And the problem we run into is that in the monarchy, we keep hitting monarchs who run afoul of this, who lack character. Let's go back and review what Rehoboam did, right, when he took the throne. He seemed to start off well. They came to him and they said, we don't like the tax burden. He said, come back in 3 days. Right? He didn't decide on the spot. He didn't respond with anger. He said, come back in 3 days. Like, that's a good, judicious way to approach things. He goes to his father's experienced advisors. Moshe doesn't like taking 3 days. Okay, I do. I believe very much that you have to be patient. So he goes back to his father's experienced advisors. Also, check mark, right? That's a good thing to do. But then he goes off. And what sets him off, if you go back to source number 1, what sets him off, what really attracts him, is when the advisors, the young advisors, say to him, speak thus to the people who said to you, dot, 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 say to them, My little finger is thicker than my father's loins. My father imposed a heavy yoke on you. I will add to your yoke. My father flogged you with whips. I will flog you with scorpions. There are commentators who try to read the line about the finger and the loins in some other way. But everybody fundamentally reads it as a bad line. Right? I mean, what does this say to you about him? Who talks this way? What is driving him? Etty, yeah.
Selfishness and power. Like, he thinks of himself too much.
Definitely. What else? You're right. Selfishness, greed for power, but there's something else.
He's also unsure of himself. He's not sure of the first answer, so he looks for another one. He's not resolved in his own mind.
He's seriously insecure.
Yeah.
This is a guy with daddy issues.
Yeah.
I mean, not to mock him too much, I never met him, and, you know, he's in Tanakh and I'm not. But, I mean, if you're lying, what you're going to tell people is, my father's finger, you know, my finger is broader than my father's, he's 41 years old, right? He's not a little kid. He has no excuse. Moish and then Rose.
Okay, there's two points here. We have to look, first of all, at his name. His name, Rahab, is fascinating. Mm-hmm. It could mean two things. I'm king of a wide people, or I'm a wide king over all the people.
Oh, wow.
What is the essence here? Similarly, the story of the tribes that come to see him, they didn't come about the taxes. They came about talking. And it ended when he said, I'll see you in 3 days. It's not 3 days and go and speak to your buddies. You want to spend 3 days? Fine. Talk with us. Is there some talking process that is going to happen and going to the future?
Maybe.
It wasn't about the taxes.
Maybe. I like your first point a lot. The Rechavam significance of the name. I had not thought about that at all. Not on the same page regarding the 3 days, but I hear you.
How could he not be?
Because I don't think they're asking to talk to him. They're asking him to make a decision in their favor. They're not looking for dialogue. They gave him an ultimatum. We will only serve you if you cut taxes. That's not a conversation. That's an ultimatum. That's my point.
Communication, not creation.
I don't know. Rose.
So there's also, we talk about a generation divide. I mean, it's like now. You look at this guy, and he doesn't want to take heed from people who have experience. He doesn't want to understand from the experience. He only wants to take heed from his own generation. This has happened generation after generation after generation. We know the older people who have the experience know nothing. And it's the younger generation who can lead without the experience. I mean,
right.
It speaks to what's going on forever.
Yeah, I definitely hear you. This is a lesson in political science overall. Eti.
Does Rehavam know that he's only going to be ruler of Judah?
I don't think he believes that, no. I mean, again, there's an existing fault line, number one. There's an existing problem, and they're identifying as the tribes of the north coming to him. So you have that. I believe he knows about Yeravam and the prophecy to him, but I can't prove that. I'm not sure. But I want to show you a couple of things here. First of all, did you notice the opening of source number one? He went to Shechem. For all Israel had come to Shechem to acclaim him as king. That's really interesting. It's interesting because, there are a few reasons. I'm going to come back to it, actually. I'm not going to say everything right now about it. But Shechem is in the northern kingdom. Shechem is the tribe of Joseph. Right? That's actually, for those following the weekly Torah portion, Joseph was sold when the family was in Shechem. And then he actually is brought back and buried in Shechem. The The significance of Shechem is that it's part of the northern kingdom, a capital of sorts even, and also he stays there. He remains in Shechem. He doesn't go back to Jerusalem. And we know that because we read last week the attack on his tax collector. He then flees Shechem and goes to Jerusalem. Why did he not go back to Jerusalem anyway once he was anointed? Because Jerusalem is the home of Solomon. Jerusalem is the home of his father. And he has real issues here in that regard. And it's understandable. He had, look at what his father did. Right? His father, the first king of the line from Judah, his father establishes the kingdom, fights off all their enemies, wildly successful militarily, and then you've got Solomon, who finds a way to exceed his father by having this great wisdom, by building the temple, and Rehoboam needs a way to exceed David and Solomon. That's number one. Number two, his mother is from Ammon, just like I was talking about before with Rosalind. Even with conversion, you can't hide the fact that his mother's side is a nation that was despised. They were viewed as terrible. Now, the whole family comes from Ruth, who is from Moab, so it's not like this is news. It's not something new. But I think it does reflect a source of concern for him. And then I come back to that line about being anointed in Shechem. Malbim, the commentator, picks up on that very interestingly. Take a look at source number 9, please. He says, this is Rabbi Meir Leibush Weiser, he says, in truth, from the moment Solomon took the throne, Rehoboam acquired the monarchy. He is the heir. Solomon is king, therefore he's going to be king. He did not need anointing and coronation. As I pointed out from the Talmud, you don't need to anoint him. But Israel sought a claim, and they came to enthrone him, notifying him that he would not be king until they willingly enthroned him and he fulfilled their conditions. The idea was they came to him and said, we are going to anoint you in our capital. We're going to anoint you in Shechem. This is why they came to Shechem and not Jerusalem, where he would have been strengthened by the house of Judah, his tribe. But Shechem was the head of Joseph and opposed to Judah. And this is why they chose Yerubbaal from the tribe of Joseph to lead them. It's that age-old split. But this is the problem here. The problem that you're seeing in the hereditary monarchy is the insecurity of the son faced with his father's legacy. You combine that with an existing political fault line, and you have a recipe for disaster. That's really what it's about. Now, I want to come back for a second to the fact that we now have two narratives going. We have, on the one hand, the narrative that says that this is from God, and I have another narrative that says it's about Rehoboam's own actions. And what does the narrative of this is from God do to free will? So I refer you back to a story in the beginning of, not the beginning of the Torah, but in the beginning of the book of Shemot, the book of Exodus. Remember how God hardens Pharaoh's heart? Right? After the fifth plague, you launch the second half of the plagues, we start to see references to God hardening Pharaoh's heart so that he won't let the Jews go. And all the commentators are up in arms. What do you mean? Free will. It's a basic principle. How can you bring suffering and punishment if he doesn't have the option of repenting? So commentators deal with this problem. One answer that's given, Maimonides liked this answer, is sometimes a person goes too far. And God says, you've lost your right to choose. That's Maimonides' approach. But Nachmanides says, with the Pharaoh, that God doesn't take away his free will. God takes away his fear. Meaning, if you're the Pharaoh and the Nile is turning to blood and the frogs are in people's homes and beds and ovens and all that and the lice are creeping and crawling everywhere and so on through the list of plagues, you want to let the Jews go not because you love God and because you realize that it's wrong to hold them as slaves. You want to let them go to end your suffering, and because you're afraid of what's coming next. So Nachmanides says what God does in hardening Pharaoh's heart is just to restore free will, to make him unafraid. Just balance it out. And then he'll make the choice that he chooses. And that's what he says there. And I wonder if that isn't what happened here. That what God does with Rehavam is to give him the strength not to be intimidated. And then he makes his own decision. Because if you'll tell me, well, God promised Yeravam, I'm going to give you the 10 tribes. What happens if Rehavam decided not to worship idols? What happens if Rehavam decided to make peace with the northern kingdom? I would answer you by saying God has many ways to get things done. If God wants 10 tribes to end up with Yeravam in the north, he'll find a way. Rehavam decides he's not going to worship idols. Rehavam decides that he's going to make a deal on the taxation. So there will be some other cause for the north to split off. But I don't view these as two contradictory approaches to what happened. I think it was a religious issue and a political issue simultaneously. That's the way that I would look at it. You follow? Does it make sense? I mean, this is my thought. I'm not, okay. Well, I'll add one more note to this. And now you can see why I needed to add a week 4 for us to get to Josiah, because this, otherwise it's not happening. Take a look at source number 10, please. Where does this go? This split. So, first, we see a positive note. Remember that we said last week that Rehavam's tax collector or tax enforcer gets stoned to death, and he rallies the forces to go to war against the northern kingdom. So this is what happens next. But the word of God came to Shemaiah, the man of God. Say to King Rehavam, son of Solomon of Judah, and to all the house of Judah and Benjamin and the rest of the people, thus said the Lord, you shall not set out to make war on your kinsmen, the Israelites. Let every man return to his home, for this thing has been brought about by me. God says, I'm the one who engineered this. Don't fight against the northern kingdom. And what happened? Surprise! They heeded the word of the Lord and turned back in accordance with the word of the Lord. Imagine that. Somebody actually listened. Go figure. So, it took us a while to get there, but it happened. That's the positive part. That's the good part. Then turn to source number 11 at the top of the next slide, because that's the immediately ensuing passage. In the 5th year of King Rehavam, King Shishak of Egypt marched against Jerusalem, the same Shishak we talked about who sheltered the enemies of Solomon. Carried off the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the royal palace. He carried off everything. He even carried off all the golden shields that Solomon had made. There's a whole story behind these shields, not for right now. King Rehavam had bronze shields made instead. He entrusted them to the officers of the guard who guarded the entrance to the royal palace. You know why he made bronze shields instead of gold ones? Because he wasn't getting his taxes from the north. So he didn't have the gold. Whenever the king went into the house of the Lord, the guards would carry them and then bring them back to the armory of the guards. The other events of Rehavam's reign and all his actions are recorded in the annals of the kings of Judah. There was continual war between Rehavam and Yeravam. And then Rehavam slept with his fathers, was buried with his fathers in the city of David. His mother's name, once again, was Naama of Ammon. His son Abiyam succeeded him as king. So, unfortunately, the concluding part is that there will remain a war between the north and the south, even though God said, I don't want you fighting with them, as a result of the sins of Solomon, and as a result of Rehavam's insecurity. Clear? Not a happy ending, I'm sorry. But let's watch into Josiah, because Josiah is a hopeful story. So I'm just going to stop one.